My name is Yukiko Goda, and I'm from UC San Diego. And I'm coming from a real cell biological molecular end. And what I'd like to talk to you about is molecular regulation of synapse function and synapse remodeling. And what you see here is a dissociated hippocampal neuron grown in culture for about 2 weeks. And a cell like this, so here's a postsynaptic cell, is receiving inputs from axons of other labeled cells. And synapse formation appears to be relatively random, shown here. But we know that in the living brain, actually synapse formation, or the location and function or efficacy of synapses, is a tightly regulated process. And so what I'm interested in understanding is, how does one, what is the basis of molecular regulation that specifies synaptic efficacy as well as the location of a synapse? Okay.
When you say we know that the locations are tightly regulated.
So for example, there's a general overall architecture, like ocular dominance columns are present. And of course, we don't know the function of ocular dominance columns, but we know that a synaptic competition, for example, is thought to play an important role, so that if you have monocular deprivation, you could actually manipulate the architectural organization in the cortex. So even though these phenomena are observed, we really don't know what is the basis of regulation. So how do we get at this process? And I'd like to break up my talk into three parts today. So first of all, in order to understand the function and the efficacy of synapse and how that might be related to its structure, okay, first of all, we need to understand what is the role of the structural elements of a synapse in regulating synaptic efficacy. Okay, so that's part one. Part two is that, what is the role of neuronal activity, okay, in turn in determining the synaptic structure? And part three, and those first two parts are going to be at level of individual synapses. And the third part, I'll now go on to discuss what might be the molecular basis, at least some part of the story, in terms of regulating where the synapse might be in a simple network. Okay. So far, okay. So the first part is, what is the role of structural elements of the synapse in regulating synaptic efficacy? And one thing that's important, so in a cell, there's two main components of cytoskeleton. Okay, there's actin cytoskeleton, and there's also microtubule networks. What's important at the synapses are the actin cytoskeleton. So the microtubules define the axons as well as the dendrite shaft. But right at the terminals, the main components that sustain the structure appears to be the actin filaments. And we know that the dendritic spines are maintained by actin, and it's motile based on this actin-driven motions. But in the presynaptic side, the role of actin has been quite elusive. And actin-like filaments have been thought to be present adjacent to reserve pool of synaptic vesicles, which imply that perhaps actin might be important in regulating the releasable pool of neurotransmitters. Okay? But if you know that in the postsynaptic side, the neurotransmitter receptors are organized in postsynaptic density, you know, by its close association with the actin cytoskeleton, and active zone is always matched in length to postsynaptic density. So it's sort of like a zipper. And this type of structures are known in other systems of the body, like epithelial cells, tight junctions of the epithelial cells, for example. So because actin is really intimately important in regulating the postsynaptic density, it's not so bad of a speculation to say that perhaps the presynaptic active zone also might be important, regulated by the actin cytoskeleton. So, first of all, we wanted to be able to visualize presynaptic actin, okay, because this has been really difficult to do. If one were to use a conventional method of visualizing actin, all you see are dendritic spines. Okay. And the most commonly used drug is phalloidin, okay, which is an alkaloid that binds to filamentous actin. Now, if you do an actin phalloidin staining, you see cell body and you see really nice dendritic staining. However, okay, you see a lot of these spine staining, and in order to visualize the presynaptic actin, we argued the following. If we were to express a fluorescently tagged actin, okay, I'm using techniques of molecular biology, and then if we were to only express in the presynaptic neuron, okay, and then look for the fluorescent signal at the synapse, then all the fluorescent signal must be coming from a presynaptic actin and not the postsynaptic one. And so this is the experiment shown here. And this is a pair of cells. This is, again, cultured cells. And this cell is expressing GFP, green fluorescent protein tagged actin, shown in green. And this is a postsynaptic cell, which is not expressing this fluorescently tagged actin. Now, if you were to follow an axon coming from this GFP actin positive neuron, and axon is very thin, so you actually don't see the process so well. And this is forming synapses onto the dendrite of this postsynaptic cell. And this region is blown up right here. And this is a postsynaptic dendritic actin shown with phalloidin. But onto this dendrite, you see many presynaptic puncta, okay, of GFP actin that coincides with a known presynaptic actazone marker called Bassoon. And this is a higher resolution image, just show, if you were to look at the left slide. Now, in this case, the postsynaptic side is stained with glutamate receptor subunit antibody, GLUR1, shown in blue. And I don't know if I could. This is 2 microns. Blue is a dendritic spine. So let me, yeah, if you were to turn off, you know, there's a faint blue that's running along, I don't know if you can see, that's a dendrite shaft, and out of this dendrite, these spines come out, okay, and glutamate receptor is enriched in these spines structures. You can see a little bit better on this side, but anyway, for this side, and then here's a situation in which one spine is contacted by 2 presynaptic terminals, and the presynaptic side contains a GFP actin, as well as a presynaptic cytomatrix marker Bassoon. Okay. Now, if we were to do this experiment conversely and express GFP actin in the postsynaptic cell, okay, then you can visualize dendritic spine actin, okay, and not presynaptic actin. And that's shown here. So now here is the post-dendrite shaft, and there's spines coming out of the dendrite, which is being contacted by Bassoon. So again, here's a spine being contacted by 2 presynaptic terminals, and now the GFP actin overlaps with postsynaptic marker GLUR1, giving a turquoise shape color. Yeah, it's basically random. So we look for a cell pair like this. And in certain conditions, they become reciprocally interconnected. So the basic trick is that the transfection efficiency, or the efficiency with which you can express these GFP actin, is never 100%. In good cases, it's about 30%, usually about 10%. So you can easily look for, you know, cell pairs formed with one positive and one negative neuron.
And then you just inject it in?
Oh, yes. The way we do this is with molecular biology, we have a DNA encoding this construct of fluorescently tagged actin, and we put the DNA by making pores in these cell body at the time of plating. So we dissociate the neurons from the hippocampus of the brain. And then the method we use is electroporation, so we basically give it a field, put the cells in a field, and that transiently opens pores. And when DNA is present, it takes up the DNA, and then it expresses, it transcribes, and the protein is made. Yeah.
Does the GFP represent all of the actins? You know, GFP.
Yes, it's monomeric. Yeah, monomeric as well as polymeric. And so, yeah, the reason why we can see these presynaptic actin is because probably phloidin, which only binds to stable filamentous actin, is not recognized, or is not recognized in the presynaptic pool of actin. Yeah. And this overlapping staining with Bassoon was very exciting for us, because Bassoon is known to be present right at the active zone, adjacent to it, and is below the colloidal reserve pool of vesicles. So this suggested to us that actin might be present right at the active zone, and moreover, regulate the process of neurotransmitter release directly. Okay. So this is the next thing that we want to test. So now that we've convinced ourselves that there is a presynaptic pool of actin that's closely linked with the active zone, could it possibly regulate the steps of neurotransmitter release that is subsequent to vesicle docking? So once the synaptic vesicles are made, and before it could undergo fusion, it goes through several steps. So these reserve pool of vesicles has to be first brought to the specialized region of the plasma membrane, right, opposing the postsynaptic receptors, called the active zone. Okay, and then after docking, it undergoes this period that I refer to as priming, which is when these vesicles gain competence to fuse. And it might involve rearrangement of various proteins that are involved in the actual fusion process. And then, once the vesicles are fused, it doesn't simply go on to fuse, it has been primed. It doesn't go on to fuse, but it waits for the calcium signal to come and trigger its exocytosis. And afterwards, it gets taken up. I'd like to mention two kinds of release. So I'll be talking about calcium-evoked release as well as calcium-independent release that occurs spontaneously in the absence of the influx of extracellular calcium ions. So those are the minis. Now, the classic notion of actin involvement would be in regulating the reserve pool of vesicles. Okay? So the first thing was to test this idea. And the way we decided to,
can you say something about what the discussion on calcium was, that there is only one physical
condition? Yeah, so, yeah, and I'm going to come to the model later too with our actin data, but what we think is happening, or my view, is that this is just sort of a kinetic scheme, so it's not giving you anything about the number, the pool size, etc. But I think that there are a bunch of primed vesicles that are in different degrees of priming. And there is no evidence that concretely supports one model versus the other one. But my favorite model would be that there's one highly primed vesicle that's likely to undergo fusion. So there's the immediately primed vesicles, and there's not so primed vesicles.
So it's not that you have many vesicles which are the same sort of condition, but then the moment one is.
Yeah, I yes.
You say there is only one which can be released at the time.
Yeah. That would be my. And we have other, there's some projects that I'm not going to talk about today, but we've done some careful characterization of asynchronous release versus synchronous release in response to repetitive stimuli. And maybe we can come up with a model that seems to suit this the best. So we wanted to look at the role of these actin filaments, the structural components, with the long-term idea of linking the relationship between neuronal activity and synaptic structure. So that's sort of the key. Now, actin is a filament that's undergoing constant turnover. So there's a monomeric pool and a filamentous pool of actin. And in order to perturb the actin dynamics, we used this drug called latrunculin, latrunculin A actually, that favors actin depolymerization. And latrunculin does so by sequestering the monomers of actin. Okay. Now, there's another drug that I'll mention later called cytoclasin. And cytoclasin also promotes depolymerization, but it does so by capping the fast-growing end of actin filaments. So the mode of action of these two drugs are different. So then, we first look at the effect of this actin depolymerizing agent latronculin on spontaneous fusion of neurotransmitters. So we looked at the minis, and here's a control trace, current versus time trace. And in the presence of latronculin, the mini frequency was increased. Okay. And this is a time course of an example experiment. Mini frequency, or the number of minis, plotted as function of time. And in response to addition of this back application of latronculin, the mini frequency increases and it comes down, and you can repeat it, repeat this application, and it goes up again. And here's the summary of all the experiments that we've done. So in response to back application of latronculin, there's about a fivefold increase in the mini frequency. Okay. And note that during the application, this increase is transient, so it goes up and it comes down. And I'll address that in the model that we have. Okay. Now, even though the minis don't require extracellular influx of calcium ions, the mini frequency itself might be sensitive to intracellular, intraterminal levels of calcium. So we tested this, whether latronculin might be promoting mini frequency by elevating the intraterminal levels of calcium, for example, by promoting the release from intracellular stores. So this is our control condition. We do it in relatively high release probability conditions. And there's your fivefold increase. Now, even in the presence of two different calcium chelators, EGTA-AM or BAPTA-AM, we still saw about fivefold increase in minis, similar to the control. And also, under the conditions in which evoked release is completely blocked and low calcium, we still saw about fivefold increase. So it appears that this enhanced mini frequency that is triggered by actin depolymerizing drug, latronculin A, does not seem to require calcium. Okay. We next wanted to test that this effect is really mediated by disrupting actin filaments and not due to other impurities in the drug. And so we used this actin stabilizing drug, which is very actually similar to phloidin, which binds the filamentous actin that I showed in the fluorescent pictures before. This is a drug called jaspamide, also known as jasplakinolate. And if we pre-apply this drug jaspamide, an actin stabilizer, latronculin no longer promoted mini increase. Okay. So it appears to be due to targeting actin. Now, we also tried this other drug that I mentioned earlier, cytoclasin, which also induces actin depolymerization by a different mechanism. And actually, to our surprise, cytoclasin D didn't have any effect. But in the same cells, latronculin was able to increase the mini frequency. And this is actually consistent with our imaging data, because phloidin only visualizes postsynaptic dendritic spine actin. Okay? But with phloidin staining, you could never show presynaptic actin. And because phloidin binds the filamentous actin, this suggests that the pool of actin that's being targeted by latronculin and is important for regulating release is either monomeric actin or short actin filaments that are undergoing really dynamic turnover. Therefore, it's not bound by phloidin. And moreover, cytoclasin D, which induces actin depolymerization by capping the fast-growing end, is not as efficient in depolymerizing actin compared to latronculin. So this data is actually consistent with what we find. Okay. Now, so thus far, what we've shown is that, first of all, we showed that we can visualize presynaptic actin, that actin is present right at the active zone suggesting that in addition to the most popular role of actin in regulating the readily visible pool, it might also, in addition, regulate processes downstream of docking but prior to vesicle fusion. If we add a drug that induces actin depolymerization, we could increase the meaning frequency. So what is the basis for this? The classical model could be that, okay, so you're letting go of the reserve pool so that you could be increasing the meaning frequency by increasing readily visible pool size. Okay, that's one scenario. The other scenario is that by depolymerizing actin right at the active zone, you could reducing the energy barrier for fusion, thereby increasing neurotransmitter release. Okay, so we wanted to distinguish between these possibilities.
Does the truncating effect vote for
you? I'm coming to that, yeah. But before we tested that, the first thing we wanted to check was, is the readily visible pool size increased in the presence of this electroencephalon treatment that increases the meaning frequency? And so we used the trick of application of hypertonic solution, basically extracellular bath solution made hyperosmolar with 0.5 molar sucrose. And this has been done in the 1950s by Fett and Katz at the neuromuscular junction. And application of sucrose by its yet unknown mechanism dumps all the readily visible vesicles. And so whatever release that you see in turn defines a readily releasable pool. And this has been established in cultured hippocampal neurons in Chuck Stevens' lab as well. And so we tested the readily releasable pool as determined by sucrose application with or without electroencephalon treatment. And this is what we found. So here's a control readily releasable pool. And in the presence of electroencephalon, at a time that we see maximal increase, a fivefold increase in meaning frequency, we actually did not see any change in the size. And the time course is shown here. And actually, the control is white circles, so no electroencephalon application. And for black circles, electroencephalon was applied at a time shown. But the basic point is that there is no change in the readily visible pool size. Now we asked, okay, so even though the readily visible pool size is not changed, you could still increase the meaning frequency by increasing the rate at which you refill the readily visible pool. And in these time course shown here, we waited 2 minutes between each application. And during this time, it's sufficient time, 2 minutes is sufficient for this pool to recover. But if we only wait, let's say, 4 seconds, and then apply the second puff of sucrose, then the pool hasn't recovered. And so by application of these pairwise sucrose, we map the recovery time course, which should reflect the refilling rate of the readily visible pool as defined by the sucrose. And shown here, this is a percent recovery of the second versus the first response, shown as a function of interpulse interval between these pairwise application. And it's basically fit with an exponential recovery with a time course of about 7 seconds recovery time constant. And there's no difference between the control and the electroencephalon. Okay, so this was actually surprising to us in that under the conditions that we see increased release, the readily visible pool size wasn't changed, okay? And the readily visible pool size is thought to reflect the, although it hasn't been shown, demonstrated conclusively, that many people believe that it might reflect the morphological docked pool of vesicles. Okay, so that wasn't changed, and moreover, the rate at which you refill this readily visible pool wasn't changed as well. So then that led us to believe the alternative hypothesis is that this increased meaning frequency that we see in response to electroencephalon application, this actin depolymerizing drug, might be due to reducing the energy barrier for fusion, okay, of those vesicles that are already docked and at least partly primed. And if that were the case, you'd expect the release probability to increase. And so we next looked at the effect on evoked release. and that's shown here. We looked at the autaptic response, and shown here is the amplitude of the EPSCs, evoked responses, and that's again increased in response to electroencoding applications. Shown at the bottom is just spontaneous events taken from the same cell, and that goes up in parallel. And again, electroencoding effect is transient, it comes down, and then you can repeat the application, it goes up again. And the summary, So on average, we saw that 30% increase. And so the next thing we tested was if the increased evoked release is due to increasing release probability, and we asked whether it occludes or it interacts with any manipulation that are known to affect release probability. And one measure is a paired pulse response. And if you give two closely spaced stimuli, then the response to the second stimulus is always enhanced due to increased release probability. And therefore, if you already start out with increased release probability, okay, then you'd expect the paired pulse response to be actually smaller because you've already started out with some level of saturation for at least some of the synapses. And so we asked whether, in the presence of electroencoding, the paired pulse response is decreased or not. And this is indeed what we found. So here's the paired pulse response, the ratio of the second response to the first response plotted as function of inner pulse interval. And at many of the points, we see smaller response in the presence of electroencoding compared to control. It's actually not known, but it is sensitive to calcium, but it's not directly the calcium per se. So it appears to be the memory of the calcium rise that the cell experienced during the first pulse. And it might be due to modulating calcium-sensitive kinases.
What do you think the blocking reaction will block the first pulse?
Yeah, so the... If actin is depolarizing, then you get increased release. So you already start out with increased release probability. So you're actually seeing the effects of depletion, put it this way.
Well, this is the ratio.
Yeah.
Okay, is this first divided by second or second divided by first?
This is second divided by first.
Why is it better than one?
It's less than one.
Yeah, so that's why I don't say paired pulse facilitation. In cultures, you don't see such pronounced facilitation, but at short interpulse intervals, you actually see depression. And paired pulse facilitation, I think it's really actually difficult to model, and because there's multiple processes that's happening, and it also depends on whether you believe in this unique, you know, vesicle that's ready to be released. Okay, and if that's the case, then if you actually release that vesicle, then for the second time around, you actually don't have anybody to release. So you have this superimposition of this facilitatory effect on the release machinery, but at the same time, you have to worry about depletion of the most releasable vesicles. And under most conditions, then if you start out with an already high release probability, you actually start to see more prominent depression because, yeah, the argument.
If you increase calcium, then what happens to this ratio?
If you increase calcium, you see more depression. Yeah. I have a slide, not on this, but I could show you later.
And
yeah.
And the probability of the first release goes up.
Yeah.
So.
Yes.
Yeah. What is time?
Yeah, this is the inner pulse interval. Yeah.
So is this interpretation of this is that the trunking is making it more difficult to get the vesicles in ready for the second release? In other words, you're enhancing depression.
Yeah, but first of all, it's making it easier to go. But eventually, because you're making it easier to go, then you actually promote depletion. I think that will be clearer in the model. Okay. So thus far, next slide. Okay. So thus far, I showed that the mini frequency is increased, and the readily reusable pool size has not changed, and the refilling rate of readily reusable pool size has not changed. But also, at the same time, under conditions that you increase release, release probability appears to be increased. And that is because the evoked release is increased, and at the same time, paired pulse responses showed occlusion. So this phenomena that I talked about appears to be consistent with modulating the presynaptic actin. Okay? But what I showed you in the beginning, the actin is so abundant in the dendritic spine, so it's still possible that the drug is hitting on or affecting the postsynaptic actin, and by some mechanical, you know, transduction process, it could be affecting the active zone structure to modulate the release process. Okay, so there could be some mechanical transsynaptic modulation, and we wanted to rule out that possibility. Is that clear? More or less? Okay. And so the ideal experiment, okay, would have been to just put latrunculin, jespamide, which prevents the effects of latrunculin, onto the presynaptic cell and to show that it blocks the effect. To show that the latrunculin is actually mediated acting on the presynaptic actin rather than the postsynaptic actin. So you want to put the inhibitor just in the presynaptic cell, okay, to see whether the effects of latrunculin is blocked. Because the jespamide that we used is membrane permeable, fluorine is another actin stabilizer which should counteract the effect of latrunculin. But that experiment, although we tried, turned out to be difficult because the axons are a lot thinner, and we couldn't wait long enough for the drug to perfuse down the axon to the terminals. So we did the converse experiment, that is, we asked whether the effects of latrunculin is not affected if we were to put the actin stabilizer in the postsynaptic cell. But because this is a negative experiment, since we're expecting that the postsynaptic actin is not affected, we wanted to have a positive control for this negative experiment, and that we used the fact that the postsynaptic NMDA receptors are indeed sensitive to actin modulators. So if you were to depolymerize actin, and this was shown by Christian Rosenmund and Gary Westbrook in 93, the synaptic NMDA currents are actually decreased in the presence of latrunculin. And I hope there are two components of glutamatergic synapses, AMPA and NMDA. And this is just specifically looking at the NMDA component. Yeah, so this is a purely a postsynaptic change, so it's completely established. So the probability of release should be changing is our argument. So therefore, if we were to prevent this rundown from occurring just in the postsynaptic cell, we should be able to unmask the increased release probability from the presynaptic cell. So therefore, we have a positive control for the fact that the drug actually reached the postsynaptic side. But what we want to show then, that drug doesn't affect the presynaptic increased release to prove the point that it's presynaptic. And so for this experiment, we did this pair recording, and this is the example shown here. So here's the presynaptic side. We did a perforated patch to prevent rundown, and the postsynaptic side, we put in this actin stabilizer fluorine into the postsynaptic cell, which should perfused down the dendrite, and we looked at both the synaptic AMPA and NMDA component. The NMDA component is open circles, and the AMPA component, which is the component that we normally study, is shown in open circles. And this presynaptic cell happened to have an autapse with a really nice NMDA component. So first of all, we asked whether postsynaptic fluorine was able to prevent the rundown of NMDA currents And that's shown in open circles in presence of latrunculum. Then actually, as opposed to retinan, we were able to see an increase in the NMDA component, which is paralleled by an increase in the AMPA component. Okay. However, in the presynaptic cell, the NMDA component that did not have phalloidin did actually show a rundown in liver response to latrunculin. So this experiment supports the fact that latrunculin is promoting release from the presynaptic side and not affecting the postsynaptic terminals to modulate the AMPA-mediated synaptic currents. So this is the summary of what I've talked about thus far. So we studied the effects of actin depolymerizing drug on neurotransmitter release to look at the reciprocal regulation of synaptic activity and synaptic structure. This is the one of the pathways. And we found that the spontaneous vesicle fusion is increased. And this increase was transient and reversible. It was protected by an actin stabilizer, gespamide, and cytochalasin D, another actin depolymerizing drug, had no effect, which is consistent with the fact that presynaptic actin that's being hit by latrunculin is either monomeric or undergoing rapid turnover. And this effect was calcium independent. The Redly-Rousseau pool size was unchanged, and also the refilling rate of the Redly-Rousseau pool size was unaltered. At the same time, the evoked synaptic vesicle fusion was also enhanced. And again, this is protected by gespamide, and cytochalasin D had no effect. And consistent with an increase in release probability, the paired pulse response, which is dependent on release probability, was decreased. Okay.
But can I ask, in LTP,
yeah,
would burden release also increase together?
In LTP, so this is affecting neurotransmitter release.
Let's say you have an experiment which
implicates. Yeah, so people have shown that paired pulse is changed.
But
other people have shown that it wasn't changed, so it's controversial.
You believe that say, evoked release is enhanced.
Mm-hmm. And
spontaneous release also
is enhanced. Yeah, some people see it, yes, and other people don't see it.
I mean, of the people who believe in pre,
yeah,
they wouldn't necessarily agree on all.
I didn't mention, so the mini increase could also be interpreted as an increase in or waking up of the silent synapse. Okay. In my case, we can argue the fact that latrunculin is increasing mini release by waking up the silent synapse because the Redly-Rousseau pool size wasn't changed. Okay. If it's due to waking up, then the sucrose response should actually go up as well. Yeah. So in this case, it's clear. Yeah, and I did a control. And moreover, I'm about to show you one other thing. So in the beginning, I showed you the morphology of the presynaptic actin, which I think maybe it was before you came in. But anyway, so this is what I showed. So we could basically visualize presynaptic actin by manipulating which cell is expressing the fluorescently tagged actin. And in this case, we just expressed the fluorescently tagged actin in the presynaptic cell, and we looked at the synapses formed onto a postsynaptic cell that's not expressing it. And the postsynaptic cell is labeled with the GluR1 antibody, one of the glutamate receptor subunit. And here's a dendrite, and there's a spine. Okay. And onto which there's a presynaptic terminal, and the GFP actin spots are right there, which superimpose with known presynaptic cytomatrix marker Bassoon. But notice that these structures, you know, there's a really nice morphology, and we wanted to look at what happens to this at a time when we see maximal increase. Is there a morphological correlate of changes in synaptic efficacy? And surprisingly, this is what we saw. So what we did was we took a cell like that, added the drug, and at the time of maximal release, we quickly fixed the cells, okay, and visualized, you know, synapses using various synaptic markers. and shown here. These are two examples. So here's a dendrite running along and receiving various presynaptic inputs on the way. And what you see is that these, compared to these round structures, boutons, everything is now slightly elongated. And GFP actin spots are now kind of oblong-shaped together with Bassoon. And also, the postsynaptic markers seem to have stretched as well. And shown at the bottom is another example. So here's a dendrite like there, and this is a blown-up of this region, Bassoon, GFP actin, and Glora-1. So in order to quantitate this, what we did was we did an ellipsoid fit and got the ratio of the major axes to the minor axes. And if you see elongation, that ratio should actually increase. And here's a cumulative probability plot of that ratio, which we call the shape index. So this is a ratio of the major axes length over minor axes length of the ellipsoid fit. And of the about 800 or so synapses that we analyzed, see that there's a shift towards the right of the larger ratio in the presence of latrunculin. So there appears to be a morphological change that coincides with the change in synaptic efficacy. So here's the model of what we think is happening. What we propose is that because we did not see any effect on the Reli-Russo pool size or the rate at which Reli-Russo pool is refilled, we propose that in our hands we unmask the role of actin right at the active zone, regulating the process of priming. And we propose the following. So after the vesicles are brought to the plasma membrane where they dock, it undergoes priming, and we break up the priming into three stages: early primed vesicles, intermediate primed vesicles, and late primed vesicles. And this is a prerequisite for fusion, and normally the occupancy state of this late prime vesicle is pretty low, giving rise to a low release probability, and perhaps maybe only one vesicle might be able to undergo fusion. Now, in the presence of the drug, and normally actin is making this transition difficult, but in the presence of the drug, we actually facilitate the transition from the intermediate to the late stage. Therefore, we have an increased pool of these late prime vesicles, and that increases the release probability, as well as the mini frequency is increased. But eventually, this intermediate sized pool is depleted, so therefore, latrunculin effect is transient. Okay. Now, notice that the actin dependent step occurs at a later stages of priming, and we argued that sucrose is sufficient to trigger fusion of vesicles at an earlier prime stage. Okay, so this is our model right now, and we're interested in identifying the native actin modulators or actin binding proteins that might be important for priming of synaptic vesicles prior to release, rather than using a pharmacological reagent. So that was the end of the first part of the talk. Now I'd like to switch gears and ask the other question. So thus far, I was talking about what are the role of these actin cytoskeleton in regulating neurotransmitter release. Okay. So I talked about our results in actin being important for release, but we already know through work of many others that actin is important for regulating the postsynaptic receptor pool, for example, which is also a determinant of synaptic efficacy. But we showed that at a time of maximal stimulation, there is a change in synaptic morphology. Okay? So then we wanted to turn our question around and ask, what are the effects of synaptic efficacy, changes in synaptic efficacy, on synapse morphology, or the morphology of the actin cytoskeleton? Okay? And this is important because things like LTP, or long-term LTP, is actually thought to facilitate remodeling of synapses and which might be important for encoding durable memories, which is more difficult to erase, for example, and to have a sort of a permanent imprint. So we wanted to look for the short, not only the short-term effects, okay, of synaptic activity on synapse morphology, but what are the long-term effects, okay, of synaptic activation, specifically of sorts of the kinds of paradigms that induce LLTP on synapse morphology. And to look for the long-term effects, you wanted to have a very non-invasive way of stimulating cells. So the experiments that I've talked about thus far, we use patch clamp, you know, methods. And basically, you're poking hole on the cell body of a cell. And particularly in these cultured cells, they run down. You know, after about 30 minutes to 1 hour, it's very difficult to observe the cells. So we thought that any sort of a remodeling that might take place might require more than this 30 minutes to 1 hour. And we experimented with various different techniques. So we grew cells on multi-electrode arrays to do extracellular stimulation, because the idea was to have a targeted method of stimulation. But then I bumped into a chemist at UCSD one day, and he suggested I might grow cells on silicone. And so this is our method that we came up with. And silicone has this optical property that it increases its conductivity, okay, depending on how you dope it, etc., that its conductivity is changed in response to light. Okay? So we used this, and did the following. We grew the cultures directly on the silicone chip. This is just an ordinary wafer, and we oxidized the surface slightly so that to make a thin, you know, glass-like layer of silicon dioxide. So the cells grow really just as normal as they would on regular old glass cover slips. And then we put the chip right on top of a base chamber housing a base electrode. Okay? And this is sealed from the external bath chamber containing a bath electrode. Okay? And we apply the voltage pulse across the silicon wafer, okay, which by itself is not sufficient to do anything to the cells sitting on top. Now, although at the same time when we apply the pulse, if you were to shine light, okay, only in that region of the silicone, the conductance is increased so that you can actually excite the cells that's in the light path, okay, selectively. So two things has to happen. You have to shine light. You have to apply the voltage pulse, okay? And this is a very gentle, non-invasive stimulation. And just to show that it's actually working, here we applied the voltage pulse under constant illumination, and we checked the efficacy of stimulation by a calcium indicator dye. So each time a cell fires, the calcium levels goes up. Okay, so you'll see a change in this is flow 3 fluorescence. And this is real time. We're stimulating at 1 hertz, you know, every second. So the system seems to be working, at least in eliciting this general neuronal excitation. Yeah, but the insulator rate, so we have to regulate the amount of this coating, because if you don't do this oxidation treatment, the cells don't actually like to grow. And actually, the cells are sitting on a bed of glia, too. And so, yeah, we had to play around quite a bit in terms of how much voltage to apply. And if you apply too much, then you actually basically fry the cells. Yeah, so the exactly how it's exciting, we still don't know. Yeah, that's in the works. Yeah, it's basically extracellular stimulation. And Well, you do get some current passing through just in that area, but the cells aren't really sitting right on top, so I think the cell actually experiences the field.
Well, okay, so there has to be current flow, right? It's the light which is making the cell a conductor. Before this current flow, there's no stimulation.
Well, the current flow is, well, if I understand correctly, the current flow is from the electrode to the surface of the fluid. That particular area which is lit. Every other area which is not lit.
Yeah, but the current can't flow through the silicon that way.
No, it doesn't meet the
thing. So you're saying it creates
a little bit of produces this kind of tip in the silicon, and that tip creates the electric field. I don't know, I'm just.
Yeah, that's the.
So if there's no light at all, there's no field?
No.
There's no conducting through the silicon.
Yeah, you have to shine light. Yeah, and moreover, the cell body has to be sitting right in the underneath to hit the. You have to hit the axon helix.
What are these potential differences?
4 volts. So we use.
So do you have a picture of the control like a nearby cell that doesn't fire?
Yeah, it's coming.
Okay.
Yeah. So this is just in this case. This is just extracted from the same video that I showed you, and the top showing 2 cycles of the fluorescence changes. Going up and down, and we looked at, quantified the area actually shown right here for 7 cycles at the bottom. And this is arbitrary units, the fluorescence goes, and we can reproducibly show this. Now, next we want to check synaptic activation, and here we use this membrane tracer called FM464. There's various spectral variants. And the basic idea is that each time you release the neurotransmitters, each time you exocytose, there's a comparable endocytosis so as to maintain the membrane surface area. Okay. And so whenever the cell excites and releases neurotransmitters, you get an uptake of a dye, and that way you can assess the degree of synaptic activation. And here we applied a 50 hertz 10-second train in the presence of a dye so as to let the dye be taken up. And then afterwards, we extensively washed the extracellular dye, excess dye, and that revealed, you know, punctate synaptic uptake of a dye. Okay. This is in response to shining light everywhere. Now, if we were to selectively activate a cell body of a neuron that's far away, then we can label a specific axon, you know, in the field. So I think this answers your question, in that we can accomplish targeted stimulation as long as we know who we're stimulating. Okay, so now with this method that we can get neuronal excitation and synaptic activation, we wanted to look for the dynamics of presynaptic actin cytoskeleton in response to stimulation. So the first question we had to ask was, does this physiological synaptic activation promote, you know, the morphological changes of the sorts that we saw with this actin depolymerizing drug? And moreover, does repetitive stimulation of the kind that's used to induce a long-lasting changes in synaptic efficacy, does it accompany the actual remodeling of the synaptic structure? And so we use 2 different paradigms for the gentle sorts of stimulation. We use a 50 hertz train lasting for 20 seconds. And for the kinds of stimulus that's normally used to induce long-lasting synaptic changes, we repeated this very single tetanus application 4 times over 15-minute intervals. So this whole thing, the second paradigm, took 45 minutes. And this is the response to a gentle sort of stimulation. And what you see is there's the axon running along and making an en passant kind of a synapse. So there's just an actin, presynaptic actin puncta. And the video that you're about to see has been compressed in time about 30-fold. And okay, so and what you'll see is that with time, with stimulation, this actin is going to condense towards one phase. it's a very quite dynamic structure. So even under resting state, it's quite mobile. And now it's starting to condense towards one phase. And so this is reminiscent of this ellipsoid shape that you saw with Latrunkin at a time of increased stimulation. Yeah, so that's shown at the bottom. The top is just the control to show that, yes, the presynaptic actin is highly dynamic, but there is no overall change in shape shown here. The last trace is a superposition of the color encoding of the first and the last image. But in response to a single tetanus train, the 50 hertz train for 20 seconds, at time zero, this is the presynaptic puncta of an axon running along here, and here's a dendrite. Now, at 5 minutes after the train, so this is, it's a relatively slow process, okay? So you see this condensation towards the dendrite. Okay, and this is just to show you even better that it's actually moving towards the dendrite. We use different spectral variants of actin expressed in postsynaptic cell versus a presynaptic cell and image the synapses. So shown in green is the presynaptic actin here, green encoded. And here's a dendrite, and here's the dendritic spline. Now in response to stimulation, the presynaptic actin is pushing towards the dendrite. Okay. And this is a reversal process, so it goes back to the normal shape. And that was a reversible change in response to single tetanus. And we wanted to do the repeated stimulation. And this is the kind that produces long-lasting change in synaptic efficacy. And surprisingly, this is what we saw. So shown on the left are the en passant type synapses that's formed along the axon, okay, that's running along. So this is shown at different time points. This is time zero. And we start this repeated tetanus, which is over in 45 minutes. But by 1 hour, you see many new puncta being formed, okay? And more prominently, by 2 hours after the initiation of the stimulation. So new spots appears. And moreover, the new spots that appear contain functionally recycling vesicles, because here's a portion of the axon which at time zero had no spots, and by 3 hours after stimulation, three new spots appeared. Okay, now two of which were able to take up the dye FM464, shown in red at the bottom. So they appear to be active synapses. Now on the right is a terminal kind of synapses formed at the end of an axon, and here we saw a rather dramatic splitting of a synapse. So at time zero, there's two spots, and 30 minutes into initiation with stimulation. So the first thing you see, obviously, is the condensation of actin towards the dendritic spine, now towards the active zone. And after the actin condenses, it seems to form a torus kind shape, which is reminiscent of perforated synapses, which has been argued as an intermediate structure that's observed in response to LTP. And following a torus, you see the puncta splitting into tiny little spots. And then two new spots appear for each of these spots, smaller spots. And these are actually stable, so you can see these structures, these newly formed structures, 16 hours after stimulation. And I think this is something that having these non-invasive stimulation method allows us to do quite easily. Yeah, so our standard experiments record for 4 hours. We do the optical recording for 4 hours. Yeah, but some of the experiments we looked basically a day later, and you find the same synapses and it's still there. Actually, I don't have, I have it on my computer, and we also looked at the cells in which both the pre and the post were labeled, and the initial contacts are kind of loose. And over time, the contacts become more secure. it's flat, though the adhesion is a lot more complete. So,
is your chamber closed?
No, it's not CO2. This is basically in saline. Yeah. But it's at room temperature, so everything is slowed down. So this process might occur a lot faster if we were to warm it up to 37. But you also tend to kill things more quickly as well. So there's a counterbalance. So I just wanted to point out, so two things. We were able to see both splitting, okay, as well as formation of new puncta. And it's been speculated, the splitting of the synapses have been speculated to occur, but this de novo kind of a new puncta formation was quite unexpected. Okay, this is a quantification, and this is during the controlled 2-hour period without stimulation, there's a balance of new puncta gain versus puncta lost. So there's a turnover of these spots. But in response to stimulation, this multiple tetanus train facilitates the gain appearance of new puncta without changing the rate of loss. Okay, so there's about fivefold increase. Now, we wanted to do some pharmacology, so look for the properties of this new puncta gain. And the obvious thing was to block the postsynaptic receptors. So is there a glutamate receptor requirement for this? And it does need it. So if we were to apply stimulation in the presence of APV that blocks NMDA receptors, you block the new appearance of new synapse puncta. However, in the same preparation, once you were to wash out the drug, then you can elicit the appearance of new puncta formation. Also, the AMPA receptors appear to be needed, and this might be required to actually facilitate the opening of the NMDA receptors to create sufficient depolarization to get rid of the magnesium block of the NMDA receptors. So CNQX, which blocks the AMPA receptors, also blocked. And interestingly, we promoted synapse loss, and we're in the process of investigating the reason for this. But CNQX has been shown to act as a partial agonist, which might facilitate uptake of AMPA receptors, okay, internalization of AMPA receptors. So that might actually contribute to synapse loss observed here. But in any case, as far as the new synapse gain is concerned, after washing out the AMPA receptor blocker CNQX, we can again increase the new puncta formation. Also, this process requires calcium signaling in that EGTA-AM blocks the phenomena. And we use the EGTA-AM, we confirm that under these conditions, the release process is not affected. So the total output during this 50 hertz train is not changed in the presence of the drug. So it has to be acting downstream of the release. And since NMDA receptors promote influx of calcium, it's possible that it's reflecting that. Also, RP-cyclic AMP is a cyclic AMP antagonist, and cyclic AMP signaling appears to be important for the appearance of new synaptic actin puncta. So, thus far, I talked about the presynaptic actin, and we also looked at the postsynaptic dendritic spine actin to see how it might change. And for those of you who aren't so familiar, this is to show that the dendrites are really dynamic. So the presynaptic structure was quite dynamic too. And this is dendritic actin and it's quite motile and moving around. This is from a relatively young culture, and again, this is compressed about 30-fold. Should we? No, these are young ones. I'm going to show you the synapse, the next slide. These are filopodia, yeah. So this is a 10-day-old culture. Most of our remodeling experiments were done in 2 to 3 week-old cultures after they form the spines. Yeah. This one? Like these things?
Yeah, the left of it.
Oh, yeah, this looks like a, yes, it looks like a branch. Alternatively, it could be an axon of another cell coming. Sorry? Oh, there is. Yeah, yeah. But they don't form spines as readily. Yeah. So they have a lot of shaft synapses at this point. But this is sort of a side thing. I just wanted to show you this video just to see how things are dynamic. So again, for the dendritic spines, we looked at the response to a single tetanus application and also the response to a multiple tetanus application. And this is a summary of what we saw with single tetanus application. So these are reversible changes, and we saw two types of changes. One was that we saw a lateral expansion of the dendritic spine, the cup sort of expanded, flared sideways, shown here, which reverted back to its initial size. Okay. The other thing we saw was that this is a lot skinnier kind of a spine, and the actin seemed to spread towards the base of the spine. So sometimes we see spread, and also other times we see a noticeable retraction. And we're just beginning to characterize this, but note that the fluorescent level also increased too. But I just wanted to show you. Yeah, in this case, this is accompanying the presynaptic condensation towards the active zone. You can also see a bit of a retraction of the dendritic spine cup. So it's retracting towards the base. So it's sort of like a push-pull mechanism. And this is a video of the flaring of the spine actin. It's from the same video sequence or the clip that I had. And the stimulation is the time when you see these very bright image. So now stimulated, and you're going to see this kind of flaring. There it goes. See that? No. Okay. Now this is the spreading of the actin towards the base, the spine. Oops. I think it's being stimulated now, so it's the fluorescence increases and it goes towards the base. It's subtle, but it's definitely discernible. Yeah. Yeah, this is with just one tetanus train. 50 hertz for 20 seconds. Yeah, 30-fold. So this is about a 5-minute clip.
Yeah.
Uh-oh, something bad happened. Sorry?
Why does it get a bright?
Yeah, we don't know, but it doesn't seem to be an artifact, so it looks like GFP actin monomeric ones perhaps is coming from somewhere. Yeah. Okay. Does anybody have any suggestions?
Exit?
So this is in response to a multiple stimulation, and this is control frames, and here is the last of the so we repeat the single tetanus four times, and this is with the third train, and this is with the fourth, and immediately after the fourth one, we see these spinules that's coming out of the dendritic spine head. And this spinule actually appears to contact the presynaptic puncta, because in this case, there's a postsynaptic dendrite in the spine coming out, and this is a presynaptic puncta from an axon. We know this because we basically follow the labeled axon as well. And unfortunately, this is in the same color, but in response to stimulation, there's a bridge that's formed between those two. And here's a video of the spinule formation. So you're going to see the little process coming out of here. And so finally, all these processes, just a brief recap. So with response to gentle sorts of stimulation, we can see reversible changes, like a seesaw-type changes in the pre- and postsynaptic actin. Presynaptic actin pushing towards the dendrite, and the dendritic spine actin sort of retracting away and also flaring sideways. But with repeated stimulation, we can induce remodeling that appears to be relatively permanent, and you either see splitting of the existing presynaptic terminals, or you see formation of new presynaptic actin puncta, and these newly formed puncta appear to be contacted by processes extending out of the dendrites. And this is reminiscent of interactions that's occurring between the pre- and postsynaptic sides during de novo synaptogenesis in very young cultures. And this is just an example of an interaction occurring in young cultures to point out some similarities. And some of the things I like to sort of emphasize is that there appear to be these little packets of actin running along what appears to be axons. And these might be zooming back and forth, you know, looking for where might be a nucleation site. You know, in response to activity, you might have to quickly recruit new structures. And eventually, you'll find that this dendritic growth cone is going to contact this one, this presynaptic site. And here's a fork-like thing coming out. And that seemed to grab onto and stabilize it. So now, so the bottom line is we now have an assay to study these activity-dependent remodeling of synaptic structure. And so we're very much interested, being a cell biologist, I'm looking at the molecular machinery in that subsurface type. So the key is, so during development, neuronal activity is not required, but at a relatively mature cultures, I mean, you could still argue that culture is a developing system, but they do have dendritic spines, etc. So what transduces neuronal activity, you know, what signals that into telling the synapse to, you know, form, you know, new structures in a nearby location? Yeah, they do. Yeah. But, so this is my last part of the talk. And even though activity is not required, you know, for synapse formation per se, and this is not just in cultures too, but in an animal too. So we, with, you know, molecular biology, you can make mice that lack the ability of the synaptic vesicles to fuse. And if you look at the brain of these mice, they actually form synapses, but they don't seem to be able to maintain, and they actually die, you know, after birth. But at the time of birth, yeah, surprisingly, they do. But, so coming back to my initial starting point is that the synapse formation appears to be relatively random, but the synaptic competition, for example, is important for defining the neuronal architecture, like ocular dominance columns. So how do they do it? You know, what is the molecular machinery? And because we have these nice cultured system where you can visualize where the synapses are, where the cell bodies are, we wanted to come up with a very simple scheme to study the basis of synaptic competition. And so this is our assay. If you grow cultured hippocampal neurons in these micro island of glial cells, you can find a situation in which only two cells, two neurons, end up on an island of astrocytes. Okay, so here's an example, the two cells on an astrocyte. And these neurons become reciprocally interconnected to each other. Okay, they always do. And so they form four inputs. So each neuron forms synapses onto themselves that we call autapses. And in addition, each neuron receives innervation from the other partners, like so. So then, if we were, so we made the following argument. In order to study the molecular mechanisms of competition, okay, so then each cell receives two types of inputs. Let's say if we take the synapse or cultures from a wild-type neuron, and the other neuron could be from a mouse which has a mutation in some known synapse protein, and we make an argument that any sort of synaptic competition must at some point act through proteins that are resident at synapses. So in those cases, if we complement a wild-type cell with a mutant cell, then each cell receives two different kinds of inputs, either a wild-type input or a mutant input. And the mutant cell also receives a mutant input of same autapse as well as a wild-type input. Okay. And we call the self-inputs autapses and the reciprocal inputs heterosynapses. And so under these competitive conditions, we can assess the impact of the mutation over the wild-type input. Okay, so this is our assay to study synaptic competition. And the protein we chose is a protein called synaptophysin 1. It's a highly abundant synaptic vesicle membrane protein, which is ubiquitously expressed throughout the brain. Okay, and no clear function for synaptophysin has been known to date. This is a study done in Mooming Poo's lab, who's visiting here on Wednesday. They showed that antibodies to synaptophysin appear to reduce neurotransmitter release, okay, in Xenopus neuromuscular synapses. And also, more recently in Eunice's group, peptides that impair synaptophysin binding to a protein involved in endocytosis of synaptic vesicles appear to impair this uptake of synaptic vesicles following neurotransmitter release. However, mouse knockouts, okay, mouse carrying a deletion in the gene encoding synaptophysin 1 created in Tom Sudov's lab, showed no phenotype that were consistent with these two scenarios. So the exact function of synaptophysin had been completely up in the air. And more recently, there's some studies have implied that synaptophysin interacts by through its interaction with another synaptic vesicle protein known as synaptorevin or VAMP, might play a role in synapse maturation. So therefore, we just they're healthy. They're fine. Yeah. And Siegelbaum's lab, in collaboration with Tom Sudoff, looked at their LTP. They looked at release probability. Nothing has changed. So yeah, synaptophysin 1. And there's a homolog, but I will come to the phenotype, though. So we wanted to look for the effect on synaptic competition in our assay. So we got the mice from Tom Sudoff lab. And this is what we did. We dissociated cultured hippocampal neurons from either the wild-type mice or the mutant mice, labeled with a fluorescent dye, dye I or dye O, and co-plated them and looked for islands containing one green cell and one red cell, a mutant and a wild type. And then, following this, we processed these cultures for staining against synapse markers, okay, to discriminate the wild type inputs versus the mutant inputs. The wild type input would have markers for synaptotagmin, another synaptic vesicle marker, and synaptophysin. Okay? Whereas mutant synapses would only stain for synaptotagmin and not contain synaptophysin. So by this, we can discriminate the mutant versus wild-type inputs. Okay, and this is what the experiment looks like in reality. So the top is the identification of the wild-type and mutant cell pair. And here's an island containing two cells. We know because the cell bodies are pretty easy to tell apart. There's some debris that you see. Now, the dye used gets taken up into glial cells. So those are the red spots that you see. However, the neuron shown here, we know that it's synaptophysin mutant neuron. And the neuron shown at the bottom, we know it's wild-type neuron. And after identifying this, we process it for immunocytochemistry against synapse markers to distinguish synaptophysin mutant synapse or wild-type synapse. And the synaptophysin staining is shown here, and synaptotagmin staining is shown here. And here's the superposition. Okay. And this is to show you an example of how we discriminated autaptic inputs versus heterosynaptic inputs, okay, onto a given cell. So the example shown is that how did we discriminate wild-type versus mutant input into a synaptophysin cell. So we looked at the dendrite coming out of synaptophysin mutant neuron. And here shown at the right is a blown-up view of this squared boxed region. And along the dendrite, if we did a double labeling for synaptotagmin and synaptophysin, and green is labeling just for synaptotagmin, and so in this case it's lagging the synaptophysin signal, so therefore it must be an autapse which is formed onto this mutant dendrite. Whereas other spots that contain both synaptophysin and synaptotagmin markers shown in yellow must be a heterosynapse. So we basically did this sorts of analysis looked for the density of either mutant autapse or mutant heterosynapse along a given dendritic length. And here's what we found. So we examined four different inputs, okay, the wild-type autapse or mutant heterosynapse, or wild-type hitter synapse or the mutant autapse. And he basically compared either autapse or hitter synapses density. Okay, and then shown here. So for autapses, that's shown in closed triangles. And here's the density of the wild-type synapses versus the mutant synapses. And you see that there's a definite bias. There appears to be a bias towards wild-type synapses, although some of them fall on the line with slope of wind. But there seems to be a prevalence of autapse formation for wild-type, but also for hitter synapses. So there's also more cell pairs that show a bias towards formation of wild-type. Yeah, that's right. So this is a scatter, this is the raw data of analysis of, I think, 13 cell pairs. So each point represents the wild-type density versus the mutant density. Per the unit dendritic length. Yeah, and we did it for many number of segments. Yeah, as long as, it was difficult to do the total dendritic length because the cultures are all messy. So, and this was actually very exciting for us because I think there's this is the first description of actually the phenotype of the synaptophysin mutant mice. And this was correlated with electrophysiological recording. So the bias towards the wild-type synapse formation was reflected in the synaptic strength. And this is for one cell pair. This actually experiment is really difficult to do, so we don't have very many examples. But for hitter synapses, the wild-type input is bigger than the mutant input. And, this is shown here, and this is the density. So the electrophysiological recordings are paralleled, and also for an autapse. So the wild-type is bigger than the mutant. Okay. So.
Is the network spontaneously active or?
Yeah, the.
The
network is, this is 12 days.
Really?
Yeah, after culturing.
So they're not 12?
12 days.
12.
Yeah, but the autapses don't spike as much. Yeah, so this one has not been manipulated with any sorts of drugs. Yeah, there are some spontaneous means, but for some reason, autapse don't spike as well as. It is. I'll come to this. Yeah.
So autapses don't spike as frequently. It's presumably the same cell
as
making both heterosynapses and autapses.
Yeah, so if you look at the synapse density for autapses, it's actually a little bit lower. And it's kind of getting to gory detail. So that's why we didn't compare the ratio of the wild type versus mutant for a given cell, but we compared the wild type versus mutant for autapses versus heterosynapses. And it was okay because it was totally closed symmetrical system. For a given cell pair. Yeah. But I think it might be for heterosynapses. We haven't done it systematically. Yeah. So next we wanted to make sure that the previously reported phenotype for synaptophysin was true. So if the effects that we observe is due to the fact that we have these heterogenotypic conditions, competition of the wild type versus the mutant, then we shouldn't see any difference in homogenotypic cultures. So we cultured either mutant neurons or the wild type neurons separately. And under those conditions, there is no difference in synapse density. And so we looked at the autapses of the wild type culture or the mutant culture. And this is scatter plot, this is average plot, there's no difference. Now, even though there is no difference, perhaps because we compared the synapse density formed onto a unit dendrite length, okay, if the total length of dendrites different, for example, there could still be a difference. So we wanted to make sure that that wasn't different. So we did a dendritic staining with MAP2 and measured the total dendrite length and saw that there is no difference between the wild type and the mutant. So the and this is consistent with previous characterization of the synaptophysin mutant mice, in which all the synapses lack synaptophysin, and there appears to be no manifestation of the effect. So now, because a lot of these competitive mechanisms are dependent on activity, this is coming to your point, so we asked whether blocking activity influences this bias towards the wild-type synapse formation. And indeed, when we grew the cultures in the presence of TTX, or under blocking postsynaptic receptors, we basically did not see any bias towards the wild-type synapse, but now no longer there is no favoring of either wild-type or mutant. So therefore, synaptophysin appears to play a role in this competitive opicotoxin, blocks GABA receptors. Okay, so here's our basic observations. Synaptophysin mutant synapses form at lower density than wild-type synapses in heterogenotypic cultures under competitive conditions, whereas the mutant cultures show no defects if the cultures were grown separately, okay, in homogenotypic cultures. And the relative reduction in the mutant synapse density is reversed when the cultures are grown in the presence of activity blockers. And so therefore, we conclude that synaptophysin plays a role in activity-dependent synapse formation and or stabilization. Because we only looked at one developmental time point, we cannot discriminate between the two processes. And how it's acting, we think that synaptophysin may act as a downstream target of some trophic factors, which in turn is important for actually stabilizing the synaptic terminal or assembling the presynaptic terminals. So in summary, I talked about three things today. First of all, that actin modulates neurotransmitter release at the active zone, and neuronal activity is able to regulate pre- and postsynaptic actin dynamics over short term. We saw reversible changes, and also we saw permanent in the sense that things weren't altered 16 hours later. And finally, at a more of a simple circuit level, we saw that synaptophysin appears to play a role in synaptic competition. So,
is your synaptophysin results consistent with Mooming too?
No, so Mooming saw a block in neurotransmitter release, but the knockout mice did not. Yeah, and this could be differences in.
How about in your hands? Did you notice?
Yeah, we didn't do. Steve Siegelbaum did a careful analysis of changes in release probability, and there's no change. And synaptophysin thing is actually interesting because so this says that in the mouse knockout, in which everybody's lacking synaptophysin, and there shouldn't be an effect. But if you have a transgenic animal in which, let's say, some neurons are expressing synaptophysin, whereas other neurons are not, then the mice should have behavioral deficits. Yeah, and in schizophrenic patients, actually, the levels of synaptophysin changes in the hippocampus. So this is like really far-fetched. But to acknowledge people who did the work, Leila Tarsa, who was a master's student, did the synaptophysin work. And this is Miguel Morales, a postdoc in the lab. He did the first part, the actin regulation of neurotransmitter release, and Michael Colicos did the silicone work. So, that's it.